reaching into your community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, you're listening to the Space Show with Andrew Rennie, and this evening we bring you the fourth in what we have extended out to five programs devoted to the International Space Station. This program is both a look back at the first 10 years of space station operations and a peek forward to the future of mankind's orbital outpost, including plans for commercial crews. Our next program, which we hope to have on air next week, will be an audio feature entitled 10 Years and Counting, and a peek into the comings and goings of what we can expect on the space station during the remainder of this year. Now, as with previous shows in this series, we are going to begin with the Beatles tribute band Love and Mersey, and they are going to be performing Back in the ISS. That's right, back in the ISS, not back in the back in the USSR. And we invite you to pay close attention to the lyrics.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop.
Was music and lyrics by Jan Holders and the Beatles tribute band Love and Mersey. Now, the International Space Station is the largest structure ever assembled in space. It's as big as a football pitch and has now been continuously inhabited for more than 10 years. Under initial planning, the space station construction was to have been completed by 2005. It was then to have a 10-year operational life before being deorbited. For many reasons, the main assembly was not completed until last year. At that time, it was decided by the partners, that is the United States, Russia, Japan, Europe and Canada, to extend operations through to 2020. Reporters at a space station briefing last month wanted to know whether the program could be extended beyond 2020. Space station program manager Mike Saffredini fielded that question.
Thanks very much. Todd Halverson of Florida Today for Mike Saffredini. Mike, I'm wondering if you could tell us what the earliest date is that you believe you guys might be able to fly an analog-type Mars mission on the space station. And could you also update us on your analysis of how long the station could actually operate? I think you were looking at whether it would be structurally good through 2028. Thanks.
Let's see. The answer to the second one is, of course, we're approved through 2020, and we haven't actually completed all of our analysis through 2020, but it takes time. And it really, from a 2020 perspective, you have to just approve or complete the analysis on all the components that flew before the Columbia accident. All the components that flew after that actually don't reach their 15-year life until 2020 or beyond. So anyway, that analysis is still going on. We actually finished that in the late 2013 timeframe, but all the data we've seen so far is very positive. And so as we've stepped through the older elements first, we haven't seen anything that causes us concern. We still have work to do to close out a couple areas, and then finish up the newer modules, which you would expect will not have don't have as much life, and so you would expect to be easier to clear. All of the work we're doing, as you said, however, we when we began this process, since the what the law says is 2020 and not to preclude going beyond 2020, we kicked off the effort assuming 30-year life of the oldest elements, which gets you to 2028. And again, we're still doing the analysis. We got even further to go to get to 2028 with some of the components. But the life work we've done, we're doing in phases 1, 2, and 3. We're just about done with phase 1. Phase 1 was all the elements flew up through the airlock, the 7A flight. We have some question mark areas where you have to go in and then do a more detailed analysis to clear certain areas, but all that analysis is assuming 2028. And that's all the work we've been doing. So as we go a little further along, as we clear the phase one effort and move to complete phase two, we're completing it all the way to 2028. And my prediction is while we may have to do one or two things to clear a couple of individual components to get all the way to 2028, I don't expect it to be anything overwhelming that would be a driver to us not extending the life of ISS.
And then that question about the analog.
Oh, I apologize. Thought I was done there. Analog. You know, it's a little too early, Todd, for me to quote times, but it won't be in the near future. You know, it's probably not reasonable to expect us to be able to do this sooner than, you know, 2 or 3 years from now to get started in that process.
Anything else, Todd?
And I need to clarify that, Todd, before you run away. As Dina says, we actually are already starting the work towards that. I assumed your question meant that we'd be extending the crew on orbit, that the crew's on orbit time, and that will take us a little while to get to the point in our process of gaining more and more experience of long-duration spaceflight that we do that. And one of the things, as part of the human research effort that we have to discuss, and it's already come up, is, do you reach equilibrium in 6 months? I mean, is it reasonable for us to assume that anything after 6 months, if you've been able to mitigate the effects for 6 months, does that mean you can mitigate the effects for a longer duration travel? But you have to think about that across not only the physiological issues, but the psychological issues as well. And so that's part of what we will discuss as we go. I would expect, however, that the consensus of opinion will be that we'll end up wanting to simulate in low Earth orbit at least the first leg of a trip to a distant planet.
So it seems that if you have been hanging out to see the fiery crash of the football field-sized 420-ton space station into the South Pacific Ocean in 2020, you may have to wait a little bit longer. So what will the International Space Station look like in 2022? Mike Saffredini got out his crystal ball.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have another one from Quincy Sur. What will the ISS be like 10 years from now?
Well, it'll look, let's start with what it'll look like, and then what it'll be like will be an interesting one to see if I can come up with an answer to that. It'll look, let's see, in 10 years, our Russian colleagues, as we mentioned, will add a module called the Multipurpose Laboratory Module. That's coming towards the end of 2013, as we understand it, and it will have a docking ball on the bottom of it as well. We are going to add docking. We already have two APAS docking ports, but the team is looking at international docking standard and having that implemented in time for the commercial crew vehicles to show up. So from a outside looking in, it'll look a little different. We'll probably still put them on the PMAs, and so it may be hard to notice. In addition to that, I'm thinking there's going to be some research opportunities are going to bear themselves, and we'll be utilizing additional ports. One is there's been some discussion about perhaps a demonstration of an inflatable module that we would bring to ISS for some time and plate and see how it works in the around the confines of ISS to decide if it has applications for the future. If we look beyond 2020, you may even see another solar power module on the Russian segment to provide additional power to it as they try to do more and more experiments on the Russian segment, and the solar arrays that are on orbit today get a little older and a little less efficient. So from the outside, it'll look a little different, but not dramatically different than it looks today. Would be my answer. How it's going to operate, I think you're starting to see the evolution of where we're going to end up. The operations team is going to be in the background running, like Dina said, doing amazing things, because there's going to be anomalies to solve. There's going to be vehicles coming and going, crew members doing EVAs. But you're going to see the focus is going to be on what have we done on ISS. It's going to be more of what research did you do. Getting things done no longer is about the assembly job or the maintenance job. Getting things done is about what research we did for who and what the benefit is to the Earth. And the operations piece will, while still be going on, will start to, I think, evolve a little bit more towards the back seat until the next major problem occurs, and then we'll all remember why that the ops guys are there and why they're there. I think that's the evolution we'll see as the program, I hope, as we evolve over the next few years, that we'll really begin to see why ISS is there, the benefit it has to humankind in general, and start to look for that each day. What happened on ISS today? What's going on? What's the application for my life on the ground? And a lot of that is going on, as Tara told you, and I hope that comes to the forefront as the years go on.
Mike Saffredini, the Space Station Program Manager, with his vision of a 23-year-old orbital outpost. In Washington, the congressmen looking into NASA's budget are also wondering about the future of the space station. Several weeks ago, NASA's administrator was called before the House committee hearing to explain the president's budget request. Under the American system of government, the heads of agencies such as NASA are appointed by the president, not by Congress. In America, the budget is proposed by the president, but actually allocated by Congress. As a consequence, a fair bit of negotiation goes on between the president and his heads of administration and the Congress. This hearing we're about to eavesdrop on is part of that process. Mr. Wolf is a member of the House of Representatives, and he wanted to know from the four times former astronaut turned administrator Charlie Bolden about the future of the space station beyond 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Culberson. I have a number of questions. We're going to go back, but I want to kind of spend a little time on the commercial crew issue, which I think is an area of a lot of concern with regard to the cost. And NASA's commercial crew development strategy has a total price tag of about $5 billion. Under current assumptions, that money would produce crew transportation in 2017 to serve as a space station to which the administration is only currently committed through 2020. From a purely fiscal perspective, why does it make sense to invest so much money in a capability that might only be used for 3 years?
Congressman, we think that provided the international partners and the scientific and technological community of the United States are willing, space station can be extended well beyond 2020. We've already completed the engineering certification, so we are not planning, I mean, I don't have it funded yet, but we are not, I am not planning to end utilization of space station in 2020.
Well, you probably won't be here, so.
My job is to facilitate the ability of future administrators to do the things that I cannot do given the current constraints, and that is, for example, to be able to execute a robust flagship mission that will include the outer planets, whether it's Mars or Jupiter. You know, we've got Pluto New Horizons on the way. That will give us information we don't have right now. We've got Juno on the way to Jupiter, so we will learn things about that planet.
Okay, coming back to the commercial crew, it wouldn't be unusual for a program of this complexity to experience engineering challenges that could cause the schedule to slip significantly, as we've seen in the commercial cargo program. How much did the commercial cargo program slip?
Congressman, I think if you look at what the original assessment was, it's probably a couple of years.
Yeah. Okay, what are the chances that technical issues could delay a commercial crew capability beyond 2017? And how does that impact your answer to the previous question?
When we looked at the date that we thought we could bring in a commercial crew program, the funding that we had gave us assurance that we could do it by 2017. So we're confident that given the things that can go wrong that we have anticipated, we think we can bring in a program by 2017.
Well, so you think there are no.
No, sir. I think there are unknowns out there, and we know about how much time it generally takes to deal with issues that you don't understand. And
keeping the 2020 date in mind.
Yes, sir.
People are talking about. Okay, last month, Space News reported that NASA's Director of Commercial Spaceflight Development, Phil McAllister, said that if the commercial crew program, quote, doesn't really make sense, if it doesn't receive the full 830 million requests this year and in the future. Do you agree with that comment? He said, quote, this is Phil McAllister, who works for you, that if the commercial crew program, quote, doesn't really make sense, if it doesn't receive the full 830 million requests this year and in future years. Do you agree with that comment?
I'm not sure how Phil characterized his comment or where the quote was taken from, but the commercial crew program makes all the sense in the world.
No, I understand. Yeah. I just wanted to know if you agreed. He said it doesn't really make sense if it doesn't receive the full 800.
I would not agree with that statement.
Okay. And given that the administration is asking for a commitment of nearly $4 billion more in development subsidies over the next 5 years, does it make sense to continue this program if it doesn't receive the full funding? So you, in essence, have kind of answered that.
Congressman, what I am saying is we have requested an amount that but I'm just saying we have agreed, because of the fiscal challenges, we have agreed to come down on the amount of money that we requested for commercial crew. Our original request was in the neighborhood of $1.2 to $1.5 billion annually to support that program, when we were trying to close the gap between shuttle and the availability of an American capability. We did not get that funding. And as I told you all last year, if I did not get, I think I had set an arbitrary floor of $500 million. We didn't get that. And so we are now stuck with a 2017 availability date for commercial crew. All I can say is if we are fully funded to the amount requested by the president, I can bring in commercial crew by 2017, and depending on what the unknowns are, we may be lucky. and we may bring it in sooner than that. But it is too early to tell. We have not even looked at, this summer we will get an opportunity to look at the proposals from industry on what they see as a system. We've not looked at systems before. We've looked at modules, we've looked at launch vehicles, but not an integrated system.
Well, I think it's helpful that you didn't agree with Mr. McAllister. That was the point.
I do not agree that any amount of money says that the program is not worthwhile. That's not true.
Well, what is the primary goal of the commercial crew program? To close the gap that we have to rely on the Russians, or to seed as many commercial companies as possible with development subsidies?
Commercial crew program has multiple objectives. My number one objective as the NASA administrator is to put a program into place that supports the International Space Station, that gives us an American capability to get our own crews to orbit and not have to be reliant on the Russians. But also, because I am the NASA administrator and I am compelled to support the national space policy, it is also to grow the economy. It is to build a viable commercial space industry that brings jobs to this nation and helps increase funding in our economy. And it is doing that already.
I would think most members up here would agree that the top priority is closing the gap and not seeding the companies. But maybe I'm just speaking for myself. During your testimony before the House Science Committee, Congressman Costello from Illinois asked you about the commercial crew program and whether it was worth the investment given the lengthy development. You responded, quote, and this is your quote, "We are going to have to develop a commercial capability for the benefit of the American economy, but it may not make it in time to serve the International Space Station." Did you say that?
Congressman, I probably said that when we were talking about, I said I don't like to deal in conjecture about funding. And I think the question sort of, if I remember correctly, it talked about what happens if you get less money, and a statement that I would make if you asked me the question. If we get less money, the gap's going to widen. We probably won't make 2017. You could fund us to a level that we could not have commercial crew available by 2020, but that still does not make the program worthless, useless. If the primary objective of some is to produce or facilitate the success of a commercial industry that brings jobs back to this country and feeds the economy, then you could do that over any period of time. That is not my primary objective. As I said before, my primary objective as the NASA administrator is closing the gap so that I don't have to rely on the Russians to take my crews to the International Space Station.
But if 2020, and you know a lot about this, and I have great respect for you,
yeah.
And I think people say that sometimes when they're ready to put a dagger in somebody.
That's okay.
I think I do. I think you are a good person. You are one of the nicest people that I've ever met in this business, and I appreciate your service to the country. So we're not trying to, but if we're talking about 2020 and we're talking about 2017 maybe, and then we have, but it may not make it in time to serve, then when Mr. Schiff is talking and Mr. Culberson is talking, I mean, I tend to feel, you know, their concern. Because I want America to be number one. So if we're even reasonably concerned that the commercial crew program may not deliver in time to serve the International Space Station, I guess the question somebody would have to ask, and I'm not saying I'm opposed to it, but why should taxpayers spend an additional $4 billion and $1 subsidizing companies to develop these systems when other programs that are meritorious have to be cut? So, I mean, is it time to revisit some of the assumptions about the commercial crew program? Now, the commercial crew people, and they're probably out there now, have hired a lot of lobbyists in this town. This has been a big job enhancing for the lobbyists downtown. But that's not necessarily what's necessarily in the best interest of the American people. So, Do you have a plan B option for the space station?
You mean if commercial crew is not available before the agreed upon time for station is reached?
Right.
Plan B for us is to make sure that we select more than one alternative this summer. To carry forward. That's our plan B. It's plan A and plan B. If we end up with one provider, the chances of being able to get to 2017 successfully and affordably is diminished. So the reason we selected $830 million is because it provides us more than one provider, more than one candidate provider. And I don't even want to talk about the numbers. The numbers depend on what the level of funding is. Ideally, you would like to have three, four American competitors vying for a contract to carry American crew members to space, such that you would have minimum of two when you ended up who are available to do that, so it's such that you have redundant, reliable, routine access to space via American companies. If we go down to one at the end of the game, that's okay, but now our redundant backup is where we are today, and that's Russia, and I don't want to be there.
Well, will we be relieved of the cost of purchasing Soyuz seats as soon as the first commercial crew capability enters into service?
As soon as the first commercial crew capability enters into service, I'm done.
So there'll be no overlap services?
To my knowledge, we have no plans to go back and forth. Once we have American capability.
We have heard of, there may be an overlap period of time. So
I think
once it's over, it's over.
Congressman, what you may be referring to is because we need relief from INXNA, from the Iran,
right,
North Korea. If we get, in order to get relief from that, it goes beyond the period that we anticipate an American capability will be available. So that may be what people are talking about when you say, will there be overlap? The INXNA waiver will overlap the time that American capability becomes available, but I have no intention of using Soyuz once I have an American carrier that can get us to ISS.
How much is it per trip?
$450 million per crew member right now with Soyuz.
$450 million.
To train a crew member and get them to the International Space Station. And that's money that is going to Russia. That is taxpayer money going to Russia, not going to an American company, not going to jobs in the United States of America, not going to any of your districts, because unless somebody there is contracting, you know, as a subcontractor to Roscosmos or to Energia, it's not coming here.
Now, I think there's a misunderstanding. That's a year. That's not per seat.
Well, it is a year that
we pay them. What is it per seat? What?
Oh, I think it's $63 million per seat.
And is the price locked in?
It's locked in for now. You know, but there will come a time if we don't close the gap.
When is it locked in until?
Congressman, let me get back to you. I think it's 2016, but I'll verify that.
Okay. The administration believes that maximizing competition is a cost control measure. However, it also ensures that we will spend hundreds of millions of dollars on companies who will never take crew to the International Space Station, either because they fail to develop a capability or because there isn't enough demand for the International Space Station transportation to award multiple contracts. How do we know the value this competition provided is worth the added cost of adding so many firms who won't make it to the end? Could adequate competition be provided through down selecting to two companies and maintaining the option of using the Soyuz services?
Congressman, our intent is to eventually down select to two or more, as you say. There is no, I don't think there is any competitive advantage, price advantage, or schedule advantage to down selecting to one at this time, or to down selecting to two before we have the proposals in from industry so that we can tell who's serious, who's following the design requirements that we have laid out and provided to everybody. And that will take us a while.
So
14 to 20 months.
So, there, you know, we defeated the Nazis in 4 years. And so there's no effort of making this basically a wartime proposal, bringing together the very best minds in the four companies or the three companies or the two companies now, knowing that everyone would get something and be a participant in some future, but in the end result is like musical chairs, there are only going to be one that gets to sit down on the chair. So there's no consideration of bringing the companies together.
Congressman, we have encouraged companies to collaborate to the greatest extent possible. If you look at, there is one potential entrant that is a collaboration of an American company and a European company. I think there is one that is potentially a collaboration between two American companies. I can't mandate that the companies come together, and I referred you to one of our American companies that I think, I'm not even sure if they're planning to propose, but I felt it would be prudent to have someone from industry say what their thinking was about collaboration. And I think, I'm not sure what he told you, but what he's told me and what others have told me is that the time to do that has passed, that, you know, nobody wants to come together right now.
I have a lot of, but I'll go to Mr. Patel.
NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden, testifying to a congressional committee a few weeks ago in Washington, D.C. More from Congress in a moment.
For local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are taking a look at the current and future status of the International Space Station. A few weeks ago, a congressional committee looking into President Obama's 2012 budget request called NASA's administrator up to Capitol Hill to do some explaining. Charlie Bolden is a former astronaut who has flown the space shuttle four times. With the retirement of the space shuttle, the Americans have only one way to get astronauts up to the space station. That is by purchasing rides on Russia's venerable Soyuz spacecraft. And by the way, that's the only way they can come back too. And we had a Soyuz spacecraft, Soyuz TM-22, land just a few days ago with three astronauts aboard. Now, NASA has asked commercial companies to develop manned and cargo craft to fly up to the space station. But the earliest they could be ready to fly American astronauts would be in 2017. With the space station officially due to be retired in 2020, some in Congress are wondering whether it is worth developing American spacecraft that would, at best, be used for only 3 years. Indeed, if there are delays in making a new spacecraft, they may not be ready by the 2020 end of the space station program, although, as we've just heard, the space station program is likely to be extended. Now, Congressman Wolf wanted to know about Bolden's plan and to purchase Soyuz flights until the United States spacecraft are ready.
Okay. Hopefully we will not have this discussion after this fiscal year.
Okay. On the space station again, NASA will need to begin negotiations soon to increase the number of Soyuz seats it has purchased to maintain International Space Station access while waiting for a commercial capability. How are you estimating the number of additional seats you need to procure when you don't know for sure when the commercial capability will become available?
Congressman, what we have done is we've made an assumption that we will have commercial, private, American commercial capability available in 2017, and so we know how many seats we are going to require through 2016, so that's the way we base our request for funding for payments to Roscosmos. I will add, because it goes back to a question I was asked earlier, we are working within the administration on the language that will come in that will request the appropriate INXNA extension that will support our requirement for additional Soyuz seats that will take us through 2017.
Well, that was the additional Soyuz purchases for crew rotation and rescue will require an extension of the exception to the Iran, North Korea, and Syria Non-Proliferation Act.
Yes, sir.
Last time that was done in the appropriation bill, do you have a legislative strategy to seek that waiver without coming to the appropriations? How are you going to do that?
I will take that for action and get back to you, because right now, as far as I know, we are going back in among the, because it's a, the State Department has concerns, the whole administration has concerns about extension of INXNA, and that's being worked through the interagency process.
Because Russia is aiding the Syrians, as you know.
Yes, sir.
And Syrians are killing their own citizens. And I'm jumping around a little bit.
Yes, sir.
I
will say, you know, we will, because Russia is a partner on the International Space Station, we will always be reliant on the Russians for certain aspects of operation of the International Space Station. So,
sure.
You know,
NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden testifying before Congress a few weeks ago. Now, last month, a media briefing session was held at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. There, excitement is building as private company SpaceX moves towards flying a test mission of its Dragon cargo spacecraft to the space station. That craft is scheduled to be launched on a Falcon 9 rocket on May the 7th from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Mike Saffredini is the manager of the space station program, and a reporter asked him to elaborate on the planning for this first Dragon test mission to the space station and for a second one to fly later this year.
Yes, hi, this is Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press with a couple questions for you, Mike. For the Dragon launch, I'm wondering if what is the payload? What have you decided to put on board to take to the space station to benefit the crew? And could you sort of talk a little bit about the demo that's going to be involved, the complexities, all that sort of thing involving how you want to make sure it's good before it comes in for a grab?
Sure. First, the payload. We have between 400 and 500 kilograms of upmass. It's low sodium food, some crew supplies. It's not one of a kind ORUs, but it is important cargo all the same. And we're going to learn two things from the demo flight. One is, can you berth? The other is how we unload and reload and the efficiencies, and learn from that as well. So actually having actual supplies on board that we need to do something with when they get there, as opposed to just dummy cargo, is really a big advantage. Of course, from the standpoint we get real cargo out of it, but also it's going to help us understand how most efficiently to unload and reload the Dragon spacecraft. So I don't have the precise number off the top of my head, Marcia, but it's in that area. Let's see, as far as the demonstration, and we'll talk about this when we have the press conference before the flight, so we'll give you a little more detail on it. But first of all, as the spacecraft is flying towards ISS, there's information you gain from the environmental models you created that you expected the vehicle to be reacting to, and how the vehicle actually reacts to it. And so the first thing we're going to learn is modeling and how the vehicle is operating with respect to how SpaceX believed it would operate. And of course, some of that's been learned a little bit with their last flight. And then as you get close to ISS, there is some specific testing of the long-range rendezvous capability and near-term prox ops capability. So we'll come up, we'll fly under the space station to do the relative GPS to make sure that system works correctly. We'll of course, in the process of doing that, we'll communicate with the vehicle to make sure the UHF comm system is working together. And then what we'll do is sort of do a big fly around of the space station, which should take us about a day. We'll assess that data against pass-fail criteria that's in the flight rules today. If we pass, we're done. The rest of the approach and the berthing can occur. And if we don't pass, we'll talk about it. And the agreement is, unless it's proved at the IMMT, they will then go and hold as part of that pattern. They'll go hold, and we'll sort through the issue and then let them approach once we've sorted it out. But then the next day, what happens is we don't just fly right in. We actually come in and we fly up a little bit to RBAR, and we get the close-in systems working, the LIDAR systems, and then we'll practice an abort away, and we'll board away a little way, then we'll hold, and then eventually we'll look at the data, and then we'll finally come up to the berthing box and berth. So we've got a couple of cases where we're going to test the far field rendezvous system and comm system, and then the next day we'll get the close-in prox ops systems. It will test the abort capabilities. There's another board actually we test further away from ISS as well. So we'll test the final abort capability, and then assuming it meets all the criteria that's predefined in the flight rules, we'll come up into the berthing box and let the crew grab it.
Thanks on that. Two more questions, one of which is, from where you sit, how important is this demo flight, how important is it for it to go well and to succeed and to pave the way for commercial cargo hauls to the space station?
Well, that's a great question. So of course, you want every flight to work exactly as you planned it. But we had initially planned on two demo flights, and so you know, if something happens during this flight, regardless of what that is, we will learn. SpaceX will learn, and then we will have to sit down and say, okay, now did even though it perhaps didn't make it all the way, or we had some problems along the way. We will assess that and go, okay, now is it necessary to do another demo flight before we decide we're operational, or do we assume we'll pick up the last piece of demonstration on a CRS type flight? Of course, the difference between the two being, you know, how much we loaded up for that flight. So that's forward work. So I would tell you, Marcia, we need to be careful not to assume that the success or failure of commercial space flight is going to hang in the balance of a single flight of the first SpaceX flight. Both of these companies are committed. The agency is committed to supporting these companies for them to be successful. They're building very capable spacecraft. So if they have problems along the way, it's the kind of things that you experience in this difficult process of trying to not only launch into low Earth orbit, but do the next hardest thing, which is to try to rendezvous safely with another spacecraft in orbit. So there's a lot of challenges with all that, as we say, or at least one of my mentors used to say, it's the first 50 feet and the last 50 feet are the hardest. And so they have to do both on this flight. So we're going to learn. And if it's not a complete success, we still learned quite a bit, and we will, you know, we'll move on to the next flight based on what we've learned and do it as well. And as we've said, we're from a logistics standpoint, we're doing pretty good. And we've got a little margin in the system, and so we need to treat this as what it really is, which is a demo flight. And as we all know, demonstrations don't always go exactly as we planned, but that's why we do demonstration flights.
Space Station Manager Mike Saffredini speaking last month at a briefing to reporters at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We now return to Capitol Hill, where NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden is being questioned by a congressional committee looking into President Obama's budget request. Congressman Fattah wanted to know more about private industry taking cargo up to the International Space Station.
It's about how you see the progress in relationship to this exciting effort to engage American enterprise in helping to carry on low Earth orbit interactions with the space station on a routine basis and the like.
Congressman Fattah, I feel very good about where we are in spite of the low amount of funding in this fiscal year's budget. We still have what I would call a very good stable of potential proposers for the commercial crew system that we hope to have in place by 2017. We know, because they have been active with us through Space Act agreements, that we have no less than seven, but we anticipate that there will be many more than that who will actually ask for an opportunity to be considered for funds from the Space Act agreement that we choose to use to develop the system to take humans to space. I'm very confident in what we have going right now. We will see, if I may add, while it is different, we will see this spring and summer the demonstration of private industry's capability of doing what NASA used to do. That's taking cargo to the International Space Station. And as I have testified to in previous hearings, that's a big deal. That's an incredibly big deal. When we have two private companies, one I think is publicly traded, the other is not, but one is personal investment, the other is corporate investment. When we see them successfully put a capsule into space, rendezvous, and be birthed to the International Space Station and become a part of the International Space Station, that is a huge deal for the United States of America.
Well, obviously, the leadership to move this forward when there was so many doubters. But you're referring to Falcon 9 and the efforts that are underway by SpaceX and some of the other companies. As we move forward, the administration's request for commercial crew is a lot more significant this year, at least based on enacted numbers from last year.
Congressman,
could you explain where you?
Yes, sir.
where these dollars would fall in play.
Congressman, if and I will just basically, if the committee will think back to the Augustine report, at that time, the amount that was deemed necessary for a viable commercial space program, I want to say, was $6 billion. And when I started asking questions about of industry themselves and others about what would it take for a company to mount a successful effort to take humans to low Earth orbit, the answer that I got was about $2.5 billion per company of NASA investment. That's not total cost. That's NASA investment. And I still believe that number to be in the ballpark. Our original request was significantly more than the request that we submitted in this year's budget of $830 million. It was $1.2, $1.5 billion because we felt that was what was necessary. And as we briefed previous hearings, if we got less than that, it would stretch the time out. We now find ourselves, unfortunately, with the gap between shuttle and American capability to send humans to orbit widening because we have less money. The ability to close the gap is directly proportional, well, not directly proportional. It is proportional in some respect to the amount of money that the nation puts forth for that effort. So less money, more time.
Discussion between NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden and Congressman Fattah on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago. Bolden was being questioned by the Congressional Committee overlooking NASA's 2012 budget request. Well, this has been the fourth in a series of five programs about the International Space Station. Next week, we have a special feature prepared by NASA to celebrate the first 10 years of continuous habitation of mankind's orbital outpost. This series is researched, written, and produced and presented by Andrew Rennie for The Space Show. We finished this program with another version of the song we first heard several weeks ago. Cuban singer and songwriter Silvio Rodriguez has written a song dedicated to Russian cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev. Krikalev was the first cosmonaut to board the International Space Station, doing so in 1998 December. During six spaceflights, Krikalev has accumulated 803 days in orbit, more than any other human. Silvio wrote this song in 1993 after Krikalev became the world-famous as the so-called last Soviet citizen. This arose because his long-duration stay aboard the Mir space station spanned the collapse of the Soviet Union. This recording of Cassiopeia was made at a concert in Havana. Cassiopeia is, of course, the well-known constellation of stars that one can see in the sky. And here we go then, we're just getting him all ready to play, and I think he's ready now, so off we go. Cassiopeia, Cassiopeia, Cassiopeia. I'm here on the space show. You've been listening to a special about the International Space Station. Just enough time to tell you as we sign off that you should be rocking up to the Space Association meeting tomorrow at that's May the 3rd at 7 p.m. in the Carnegie Room of the Oakley RSL, which is at 95 Drummond Street, Oakley. We will be looking at the current status of the International